The Selfish Brain. Two friends of mine are prominent Alzheimer's disease researchers. John Trojanowski and Virginia Lee co-direct the University of Pennsylvania's research on neurodegenerative disorders. But what I want to tell you about these scientists does not have to do with neurofibrillary tangles and beta amyloid plaques. It has to do with John and Virginia themselves. John speaks in full sentences. He is attentive to detail in everyday conversation. When I interviewed him some years ago for an investigative article, the picture he painted was like a John le Carré spy story, intricate, detailed, subtle. Listening to John was like watching a painter develop a canvas, only instead of brush and paint, John employed a series of perfectly thought-out sentences. He included so much detail that I found myself having to concentrate really hard to pick out the important points. Like any good Le Carré novel, John's account was not about bombs and car chases and hijacked airplanes, but about the passing detail of an unlatched gate. At first glance, John and Virginia seem like an odd couple. He is 6'3" tall, looks a little like Mick Jagger, and is expansively genial. She is of Asian ancestry, petite, and has the coiled restraint of a cat. At second glance, they look even more like an odd couple. Where John is verbose, Virginia is staccato. When they get angry, he exudes icy dignity and she flashes fire. John follows a simple rule in everyday conversation. Why say something in one sentence when you can say it in two? Virginia strips language to its tensile outlines, eliminating subjects and objects in most sentences, and waging an unrelenting war of annihilation against all modifiers. When she says yes or no, her eyes bristling with impatience, you have the sense that what she really means to say would take 10 minutes, but she can't spare that kind of time. When Virginia's angry with you, one friend of theirs told me, it's like she's going to take a knife and slit your throat. When John's angry with you, he'll make you feel so guilty that you will take a knife and slit your own throat. A friend calls us fire and ice, John said. You can guess which is which. I once visited John and Virginia's lab. As I was talking with an office administrator, Virginia rushed up. Here, she said, and dropped a folder before the administrator, whose name was Karen Engel. We'll talk about it tomorrow. She whirled and was gone. John would have talked about it for 10 minutes, Engel said, nodding at the folder. He is not one to make rash decisions. He wants consensus. Perhaps you know people like John and Virginia. Their clashing personalities are a cliche of television sitcoms. Experts in human relationships will tell you that while such clashing personalities are good for comedy, they're definitely not good in real life. People like John and Virginia who clash, disagree, and get on each other's nerves because they have different personalities are exactly the kind of people who should never be left alone in a room together. As colleagues, experts will say, people like John and Virginia are doomed to conflict. And if a professional relationship between people like them is likely to be doomed, a personal relationship between them would be a catastrophe. Don't think rancor and bitterness, think mushroom clouds. What I haven't told you about John and Virginia is that they have been married to each other for more than 30 years. And more than most couples I know who have been married half as long, it is obvious they are very much in love. Opposites attract, you say. Research studies contradict you on that, at least in that studies show that similar people tend to get along better in the long run, but never mind. Let's assume opposites do attract. What I find astonishing about John and Virginia is that they not only live together and love each other, but they have formed a potent professional partnership that has placed them among the ranks of the most prolific and widely respected scientists in the world. At Penn, John and Virginia collaborate to produce dozens of research papers in prestigious scientific journals. They haul in millions of dollars in grants. Everything they do is in concert, collaboration, and consultation with each other. Someday, admirers whisper, they might win the Nobel Prize in Medicine together. Bear in mind that this is a couple that argues about minutiae. Neither will give ground on such all-important questions as whether the forks should go in the dishwasher with their pointy ends up or their pointy ends down. When John and Virginia clash, they revert to personality. John becomes more and more precise, attending to tinier and tinier details, his emotions hidden behind layers of ice. Virginia grows more and more didactic, interrupting John and showing considerable exasperation at his verbal pyrotechnics. When they spar, I can see her mentally pick up projectiles and fling them at him while he sits, steely-faced and impassive, green peas whizzing by his nose. When they went on vacation recently, they argued about the right way to make breakfast cereal. When he tried to recall what the fight was about some days later, John came up short. It was so trivial he could barely remember the details, except that the fight was not only heated, but a recurring conflict every day of their vacation. If you had seen them during these breakfast cereal duels, you would not have guessed that together in their professional life, John and Virginia have bucked the neuroscience community on the causes of Alzheimer's disease. They have often been willing to stake out ground that is at odds with the conventional wisdom, the kind of position that requires them to depend on each other for intellectual and emotional support. Taking such gambles in science is not easy. It is a little like being lost at sea, menacing grey-green water from horizon to horizon, and striking off in one direction on your own, while all the other boats head off together in the opposite direction. It needs confidence, and it needs each member of the couple to have complete trust in the other. In everyday life, however, friends and co-workers do not wonder how John and Virginia work so well together. They wonder how John and Virginia can coexist. I imagine a marital counselor giving advice to John and Virginia. After hearing about the breakfast cereal fights, I see him wondering about whether the two of them are really suited for each other. John, for example, will start to describe how his day goes. We get up at 7 o'clock. We get up at 7:30, Virginia sharply interrupts. John, you think that you wake up at 7. The marital counselor raises his eyebrows imperceptibly. They argue about small things, he says to himself. Do they give each other lots of space? No. He learns that they share their professional lives, going from the same house to adjacent cubicles in the same office. Do they gingerly avoid each other in their professional life? No. They are often at each other's throats in public. I've never encountered the volatility I see between them, a lab manager named Jennifer Bruce once told me. If it happens often enough, people just say, oh, they're at it again. Bob Dome, another colleague, told me that he was taken aback when he first met the couple. Virginia is hyperkinetic, and John always speaks very slowly, so Virginia is always telling him to shut up or get on with it. I was shocked when I first met them. I didn't know they were married. Even their jokes have an edge. At a lab meeting with 24 people in attendance, John once talked about the role that brain injuries might play in the development of Alzheimer's disease. He explained that the insidious thing about these injuries is that their effects might not be visible, even to highly sophisticated brain scanners. I fell off a horse when I was 16 and I had a brief amnesia, he said. It went away, but that's the kind of thing that predisposes somebody to Alzheimer's disease. I haven't taken an MRI, brain scan, but even if I did, I wouldn't find anything. How do you know? Virginia asked, deadpan. The room erupted in laughter, and John looked displeased. I see the marital counselor shaking his head as he learns from John that their heated criticisms of each other at work regularly bring them both to the brink of tears. When we don't agree, it is not really clashing, Virginia interrupts, disagreeing with her husband about whether they disagree with each other. If I don't agree with him, I tell him. I see our imaginary therapist leaning back in his chair with a heavy sigh when he realizes the only thing that keeps them from each other's throats is traffic safety. We have one very important rule. We still bicycle to work, John told me. Whatever we discuss, we cannot fight on our bicycles because that is dangerous. But John and Virginia also have a secret, perhaps the most important secret that extraordinarily talented type A couples can have. To understand what it is, I want to introduce you to the work of a social psychologist named Abraham Tessa. Some years ago, a young woman approached Tessa and told him that she had done well in a recent class, but was feeling awful because a close friend of hers had done even better. Social psychologists are always on the lookout for behaviors that are not idiosyncratic to individuals, but that say something about human nature in general. Tessa sympathized with the woman who confided in him, but her remark got him thinking. Would the woman have felt as bad if the person who had outperformed her had not been a close friend? Alternatively, if the friend had done well at something that the woman did not care about herself, would she have experienced jealousy? Tessa intuitively guessed the answer to both questions was no. When a stranger does well at something, we can enjoy their accomplishments. In fact, when we know something about basketball or poetry, we are better able to understand the skill involved in dunking a ball or turning a rhyme. Most of us take great pleasure in watching gifted athletes and performers do things we could never dream of doing ourselves. When close friends or lovers do well in activities that do not interest us, the same thing happens. The wife who would never be caught dead in a garden can take pride in her green-thumbed husband who has turned the backyard into a horticultural exhibit. The aspiring high school football star feels his chest puff with pride when his younger sister is chosen for the lead role in the school play. In fact, Tessa sensed that in these situations, people feel happy partly because they get to bask in reflected glory. There is my cousin, who is the first violinist in the symphony, a person might think. Or there is my son, the doctor. But something interesting and potentially unpleasant happens when someone whom we are close to excels in a domain where we would like to be seen as excellent ourselves. The writer who is outshone by his writer girlfriend feels a conflict. He feels pleasure at the success of someone he loves and gets some reflected glory, but he also feels taken down a peg. He doesn't want reflected literary glory, he wants his own literary glory. This is why the 12-year-old who gets bumped from the lead role in the school play is likely to come home bemused if she loses the starring role to a stranger, but is likely to come home in tears if she loses the part to her twin sister. If the relationship is close, the jealousy gets even worse, Tessa told me. You have these two reactions to the other person. Your success pulls me up, but on the other hand, your success makes me feel like crapola. Tessa conducted a series of experiments that confirmed his hunches. At its core, the conflict between pride and jealousy in other people's accomplishments hinges on a mechanism in the hidden brain designed to watch out for our narrow selfish interests. We show ourselves in a positive light when we excel at something, but we are also seen positively when we are associated with someone who excels. The brother of the beauty pageant winner is not just another guy. Some of his sister's glory rubs off on him. Usually these two mechanisms in the hidden brain are not in conflict. Tessa's insight was that when someone who is close to us excels at something that we want to excel at ourselves, these two drives are unconsciously put into conflict with each other. The glory of our successful friends and siblings rubs off on us. But because we hunger for their kind of glory ourselves, their success makes us feel mediocre. This is why the woman who confided in Tessa was upset at being outperformed by a close friend. Tessa found that people feel very powerful resentment when their partners are successful in domains that are integral to their own identity. This resentment is so powerful that volunteers in experiments sabotage their friends and lovers to keep them from doing well at things the volunteers see as their own core strengths. Wordsmiths presented with a test of verbal ability, for example, will help strangers and undermine their lovers in order to keep partners from outperforming them. Although husbands and wives say they are unrestrainedly happy about the success of their partners, Videotaped interviews show that people's expressions of pleasure are leavened with dismay when they find their spouses have outdone them in domains they want to claim as their own. The people Tessa studied were not bad people. They had no awareness of what they were doing. Like the woman who approached Tessa to ask why it was she felt dismayed her friend had outperformed her, these husbands and wives were not consciously aware of why they felt the way they did. Not only would they not be able to explain their behavior to others, they would not be able to explain their behavior to themselves, which is how it always is with the hidden brain. In one especially interesting analysis, Tessa examined the relationships between famous male scientists and their fathers. He found that when the father and son were scientists in the same field, the success of the son predicted an emotionally distant parent-child relationship. When father and son were in different fields, the success of the son predicted emotional closeness with the father. Even when it comes to our own children, in other words, having a child outperform us in a domain where we have long sought excellence ourselves can be threatening to our self-esteem. All fathers bask in the reflected glory of their son's successes, but when a father and son share similar interests, a persistent voice at the back of the father's head asks why such success was denied to him. All this, as you might guess, spells trouble for two people like John Trojanowski and Virginia Lee. They are married to each other, which means they are close, and their professional lives and feelings of achievement are tied up in the same things. They are both smart, ambitious, and competitive. It is not just that both of them are academics. One of them is not doing social science while the other does clinical science. No, they are both in exactly the same field, working in the same university, out of the same office. They even have the same job title. Given the differences in their personalities, Tessa's research would predict that John and Virginia would quickly become envious of each other, and that jealousy and competitiveness would poison their relationship. But as I said, John and Virginia have a secret. It can be summed up in a single word: complementarity. Although they appear to be doing identical things and have identical interests, John and Virginia have figured out how to do slightly different things, to divide up their everyday tasks so that they work in complementary ways rather than competitive ways. They have unconsciously harnessed the selfishness of their hidden brain to their mutual advantage. They have agreed, for example, that she is the expert when it comes to biochemistry and cell biology, the basic tools of bench science. They have also agreed that he is the expert on clinical issues, and a lot of scientific work involves working with patients. They have also divided up the human resources needs of running a large laboratory, which is like a small business. Virginia thinks of herself as being a lab rat, and there is nothing she likes as much as discussing science with postdoctoral fellows. John is much more social and enjoys talking to collaborators, the press, and the outside world. The strategy to make sure our partnership did not undermine each other was not do the same thing, John said. We have different skill sets and different management skill sets. Even though we say we work with each other all the time, we have to get appointments to see each other. It never started out as, this is what I do and this is what you do. It started out as, this is what we do together, Virginia added. It naturally sorted out. If, at the end of the day, I'm not in town, John can substitute for me. We don't really stake out an area, but go with whoever is better at it. Given how similar their interests are and the extremely competitive structure of modern science, it is astonishing that John and Virginia have perfectly complementary strengths. But Tessa's research suggests blind luck probably played a modest role in their division of responsibilities. When couples are emotionally close, Tessa found they automatically and unconsciously stake out complementary domains. It is almost as though recognizing the potential threat that competitiveness poses to an intimate relationship, the hidden brain nudges people toward complementarity. Tessa found that if one partner has a strong preference to do task A over task B, but the other partner has an even stronger preference for task A, the first person unconsciously switches preferences and says he actually prefers task B. On his own, John might well have been a lab rat and Virginia an outgoing communicator, but in the context of their relationship, they have unconsciously adopted roles that allow them to see each other as collaborators instead of competitors. John and Virginia have also, consciously and deliberately, set up rules to reduce the risk of competitiveness. By specializing in different tasks, all of which are essential to the functioning of their laboratory, they have increased their dependence on each other. John knows he needs the engine of bench science that Virginia provides. Virginia knows she needs the engine of research grants and collaborations that John generates. Every publication that goes out from their lab has both their names on it. They both insist all recognition be shared equally, and are prepared to make sacrifices to see that this happens. John once applied for a prestigious $1 million grant that neither he nor Virginia thought was within their reach. To their surprise, John won the grant. But before he accepted, he told the organizers the grant would have to have both their names on it. The private organization giving out the grant balked. After all, John had applied for the grant on his own. John told the group that unless the grant was given to them both, he was going to turn down the $1 million. Initially, they did not want to do it, and I said, "Sorry, we don't want the money," John told me. The organization relented and gave the grant to both of them. "Neither of us would do as well on our own," Virginia agreed, "but together we work very well. People tell me you don't do anything unless Virginia gives you permission," John added. "What it is there is no single boss in our operation at work or home, and to some men that seems weak. I don't mind acknowledging that nothing I have accomplished would have been possible without Virginia." I am skeptical about the accuracy of this claim. John and Virginia are immensely talented people and would very likely have been successful if they had never become partners. But I am certain that their belief in this claim is essential to the success of their personal and professional partnership. With all their personality differences, John and Virginia have to see their individual success as intertwined with the success of the other person. Absent that belief, that bias, they would lose a very important pillar of their love. The unconscious bias of the hidden brain to look out for itself can be an immensely destructive force in personal relationships, but it can also be harnessed to create dense networks of interdependence. Unlike most couples who have been married for more than 3 decades, John and Virginia hate spending a single night away from each other. When either is invited to give a talk in another city, each invariably arranges for the other to come along too, like opposite poles of 2 magnets that cannot get enough of each other. Chapter 3. Tracking the Hidden Brain. How Mental Disorders Reveal Our Unconscious Lives. The reason people have no awareness of the hidden brain is that it is usually not accessible through introspection. Turning the spotlight of our attention inward does not reveal a subterranean world. But there are times in the course of everyday life when we are suddenly made aware of the hidden brain, not by its presence, but by its absence. Scientists, researchers, and clinicians regularly encounter patients with hidden brain impairments. As Abraham Tessa and others have shown through experiments, and as Freud intuited through experience, the hidden brain regularly causes people to make the same errors over and over in their lives. Couples that sabotage each other in order not to be outshone have no idea they are sabotaging each other, let alone why they are doing so. One of the most powerful forms of psychotherapy developed in recent years is called cognitive behavior therapy. Simply put, the technique teaches patients to become mindful of unconscious thought patterns. The alcoholic may feel his addiction is completely beyond his control, but it turns out there are patterns to his behavior. He tends to drink after he gets a paycheck, or when he walks by a favorite bar, or after a fight with his wife. Fighting alcoholism is partly about becoming aware of these triggers and consciously setting up mechanisms to guard against them. To have a paycheck direct deposited into a bank account, for example, or to walk a different route home that does not go by the bar. It's the same with depression and other mood disorders. People feel their emotional problems are largely caused by external events. There is little doubt that losing a job or a spouse can be devastating. But a core insight of all talk therapy is that a large portion of how we feel about our lives rests within ourselves, in unconscious patterns of thought and habit. Treating psychiatric ailments with medications achieves the same thing. Neurochemical changes make patients feel better about themselves. No one intuits the presence of a neurotransmitter, but depression and the effective treatments for it show that we need neurotransmitters to function properly. In recent years, high-tech brain scans have allowed us for the first time to observe the physical brain in action, to directly glimpse dimensions of the hidden brain at work. While these insights are increasingly well established in clinical science, the role of the hidden brain is disregarded in most other realms. We may concede that schizophrenia and depression have something to do with the hidden brain, but commonplace things such as table manners, politeness, and honesty seem driven by conscious intent. People are polite because they choose to be polite, and they are honest because they want to be honest. It takes an unusual disorder to reveal that the basic elements of everyday life, morality, kindness, and love, rely on the unconscious mind. Brian and Wendy McNamara live in Oakville, Ontario, just outside Toronto. In keeping with their friendly personalities, both Brian and Wendy chose sociable professions. Brian became national sales manager for the computer maker Hewlett-Packard. Wendy sold casual clothing for weekenders. She called people on the phone and arranged to come over to their homes to make presentations of the latest fashions. Both Brian and Wendy were very good at what they did. In 2002, Brian accepted an early retirement package and settled into a life of semi-retirement. He was happy to kick back, even if it meant giving up the perks and bonuses that had come with his high-profile job. Brian and Wendy were close and enjoyed each other's company. For Brian, retirement meant they could focus on things they loved to do together, travel, antiques hunting, and exploring different wineries. Life seemed full. In 2004, 30 years into their marriage, Wendy had a partial hysterectomy to remove a fibroid growth. She took a long time to recover. Around the same time, Brian sensed Wendy's drive was slowing down. Where she once had demonstrated a lot of get-up-and-go in making sales calls, she now just sat around. Brian thought it might be time for her to kick back too. He sounded her out about retiring from the clothing business and doing something else, such as volunteer work. Wendy was not enthusiastic about the idea, but she made no move to pick up the pace on her business responsibilities. Over the following weeks and months, Brian felt something else was amiss. The woman who had been his high school sweetheart seemed to be growing increasingly distant. He would propose things to do together, fun things, and she wouldn't say yes, and she wouldn't say no. When he cuddled up to her, she seemed uninterested in affection, not angry, but indifferent. In late 2005, Brian took Wendy's sister into his confidence. Evelyn Summers is a clinical psychologist, and Brian told her about Wendy's lack of emotional connection to work, to life, and to him. They discussed the possibility that Wendy was suffering from depression, an outgrowth of her lengthy recovery from surgery, or the scale back in lifestyle that had come with Brian's retirement. Brian felt that the time he now had to enjoy life as a result of retirement was well worth the lost perks and bonuses, but was it possible Wendy secretly did not feel the same? Brian asked Wendy if she wanted to talk to a psychologist. She was neither enthusiastic nor averse. As usual, she was indifferent. She met a psychologist half a dozen times in late 2005 and early 2006. When Brian asked her how the sessions went, she gave monosyllabic answers. Brian hoped she was unburdening herself to the therapist. The couple had always been intimate, but that was falling away too. Brian kept asking Wendy what was happening to them. "Are we falling out of love?" he would urgently ask. "Are we parting?" Wendy would turn his plea for connection into an argument. "Do you want to leave me?" "No," he would say. "I just want to understand what is going on." There was little by way of overt fighting. If their marriage was dissolving, it seemed to have gone from warmth and love to distance and indifference, without making the traditional pit stops at anger, resentment, and conflict. If there was any anger, it mostly came from Brian. He would go out of town on trips for a couple of days to do some consulting, and come home to find newspapers strewn around the house. There would be unwashed plates and cups on the dining table. Wendy used to be the kind of person who pushed her chair back into place after getting up from a table, and who put her cup in the dishwasher after drinking her coffee. What was going on? Brian felt lonely. It was difficult to communicate to other people what was wrong, because once he started talking about it, it felt like small stuff. He and Wendy had always enjoyed shopping for groceries on weekends and then cooking a meal together. Now, when he asked her what she wanted to eat, she would shrug. When they did bring groceries home, Wendy would sometimes put her shoes right back on and say she was going out for a walk. It wasn't possible to communicate the gravity of things like this to another person, but to Brian, who craved emotional connection with his wife, the incessant accumulation of minor events felt like the stuff of divorce. Maybe they were just falling out of love, he thought. Maybe it was his fault too, in ways he did not fully understand. Brian felt terribly sad, but knew it was hardly earth-shaking. They were going through what millions of couples had gone through before them. But there were some things that were just strange. When they went for walks, Wendy closely examined the bark on trees. She studied whorls in the wood and pointed out patterns that resembled human faces. She ran her fingers across the bark over and over, as though trying to divine some secret message. She was an amateur painter and had an arts background, and Brian marveled at her ability to find incredibly subtle patterns in bark and on rocks. When they were in the car together, Wendy counted the wheels of passing transport trucks. "That one has 18 wheels, this one has 24. On a drive to Brian's sister's house, he once saw her intently studying the passing forest. He could hear her quietly counting to herself. When she got to 200, he finally asked her what she was counting. "Dead trees," she said. One summer day, when Brian made a quick pit stop at a store to pick up some beer, Wendy jumped out of the car and followed him inside. A young couple had caught her eye. The man had a series of elaborate tattoos down one arm. Wendy approached the stranger fearlessly. "You have wonderful tattoos," she said. "Can I see them?" The young man was taken aback, but Wendy disarmed him. Her charming personality and winning smile made behavior that might have seemed weird coming from another person just seem unusually friendly. Before Brian managed to hustle her away, Wendy told the stranger about patterns in his tattoos that he had not seen himself. Brian felt the strange events were like shadows. They were here one moment, gone the next. If Wendy did something odd one day, she did not repeat it the next day. To Brian's precise mind, there was no connection between counting dead trees and Wendy's growing propensity to send off checks to buy books she did not want to read. But the odd events kept occurring with increasing frequency. Wendy went up to men she didn't know, admired their hair, and asked if she could touch their beards. Sometimes she didn't ask. Brian feared for her safety. The people she stopped were shocked, but guarded. What would happen if she accosted a stranger who was dangerous? At home, Wendy walked around at night looking at shadows, searching for patterns. She owned a lot of antique glass, and these nocturnal trips often involved visits to her china and dishware collection. She wasn't a Midas reveling in her possessions. She just had an insatiable urge to run her fingers over ridges of all kinds and was drawn to intricate patterns in glassware. The couple had stopped sleeping in the same bedroom because Wendy was so restless. Brian sometimes woke up in the middle of the night to see his wife standing silently above his bed, watching him. "You need to go back to sleep," he would say, and she would obediently comply. The couple had a grown son living in the house, and the young man had closely cropped hair. Wendy loved to run her hands over her son's scalp, feeling the texture. But it got to a point where it became weird and annoying. Both Brian and his son asked Wendy to stop. She started sneaking up and ambushing her son. It was silly, but when she didn't stop after repeated pleas, Brian felt such behavior constituted abuse. Wendy had been a great animal lover, but she now grabbed hold of the cat, set her electronic keyboard to play "The Charge of the Light Brigade," and vigorously rocked the poor animal back and forth until it was terrified. When she dropped the cat, she was mindless about the height of the fall. If the cat was left in her care, she did not feed it. In May 2007, Wendy agreed to accompany her sister and mother on a trip to France. Wendy's sister, the psychologist, had planned the trip. She was going to exchange vows with her partner, Larry. It was to be a 2-week trip with lots of fun events planned, and Evelyn Summers told Brian that the change of scenery might do Wendy good. Brian sat Wendy down for a heart-to-heart chat before she left. "You need to think carefully about what you want when you come home," he told her. "You need to ask yourself if you want to live here, if you want to be with me." Things unraveled as soon as the flight got underway. Wendy drank copiously. It was out of character. She had always been the one to stop herself and others after the first glass or two of wine. When they arrived at their destination, Wendy continued to drink, but there was something different about the way she consumed alcohol. Wendy had always been a social drinker. The alcohol had been incidental to social connection. The social connection now seemed incidental to the alcohol. Wendy's sister had rented a house from friends, who themselves lived a couple of doors away. Without anyone knowing, Wendy would slip out and go over to the home of her sister's friends, people she knew only slightly. "Hi," she would say brightly. "Can I have something to drink?" The dazzling smile would appear, and her newfound hosts would comply, even as they eyed each other questioningly. For the first time since Wendy had begun to change, she was not with Brian, but with other family members. In the close proximity that comes with travel, Wendy's sister started to understand what Brian was going through. The trip was to have been a respite, but Wendy had instead become an unwelcome distraction. Evelyn confronted her sister, but as usual, Wendy was indifferent to criticism. When the family returned to Canada, Evelyn was distraught. She told Brian she was certain something serious was wrong. This was not depression. Brian felt an enormous relief. It wasn't just him. Other people who knew and loved Wendy were able to tell something was amiss. But what could it be? He took Wendy to see their family doctor. "Why are you here?" the doctor asked. "Yes," Wendy agreed, turning to Brian with an air of curiosity. "Why are we here?" Brian told the doctor about the drinking, the apathy, the indifference. The doctor raised the possibility of depression, and Brian said that Wendy had already seen a psychologist and that it had gone nowhere. Brian told the doctor about Wendy's insatiable urge to rub her fingers over her son's scalp and the heads of strangers with kinky hair. Wendy also seemed constantly fatigued. Inasmuch as she was restless at night, she also spent a lot of the day just lying around. The doctor told Wendy she was going to order some tests. She wanted blood work and tests to measure brain functioning. The doctor then changed the topic. After a few minutes, she abruptly asked Wendy about the tests. "Do you recall I suggested doing a blood test and other measurements?" Wendy looked at her blankly. "No," she said. Brian felt another surge of relief. Someone in the medical community had picked up on something. After the tests were completed, the doctor referred Wendy to a neurologist at the Sam and Ida Ross Memory Clinic at the Baycrest Geriatric Healthcare System in Toronto. There were more tests. Finally, the neurologist, Tiffany Chow, produced a diagnosis. Wendy had a disorder known as frontotemporal dementia. Although Wendy's symptoms for this disorder began around the time when she had her partial hysterectomy, in all likelihood, the two illnesses were not related. The McNamaras had simply had two pieces of bad luck arrive at the same time. The frontal and temporal lobes are craggy outgrowths of the brain handed down to us by our evolutionary ancestors. The Taj Mahal and the Eiffel Tower, spaceships and classical art, laws and governments, civilization itself, are products of these brain areas. We do much of our important thinking here. We analyze and forecast things, make choices, and form judgments. As with the rest of the brain, much of what the frontal and temporal lobes do is unconscious. They shape our ability to judge social situations and make aesthetic judgments. And they provide us with the prick of conscience when we do something wrong. There are many neurological disorders that affect the brain, but none may be as curious as frontotemporal dementia. Unlike Alzheimer's disease, which begins by robbing the memory while leaving other aspects of brain functioning intact, frontotemporal dementia affects a part of the brain that subtly and secretly regulates our social behavior. The frontal and temporal lobes tell us whether it is polite to reach across a crowded dinner table for a dish, and how to greet someone we know only slightly. They tell us whether the person who catches our eye across a crowded bar is just scanning the room or looking meaningfully at us. They allow us to experience the pleasures of comradeship and teamwork. People with frontotemporal dementia often have extremely acute powers of observation and analysis, meaning that the analytical parts of their brain are working fine, but they don't have table manners. In Wendy's case, the gradual disintegration of her ability to judge socially appropriate behavior from inappropriate behavior took nothing away from her ability to rapidly count the wheels of transport trucks and to identify subtle patterns on the bark of a tree. The vast majority of rules of human interaction are not written down or even articulated. There is no rulebook that tells you when it is appropriate to knock on someone's door and suggest a drink. When you do it, whom you do it with, and how often you do it all matter. In India, where I grew up, it was perfectly appropriate to knock on a friend's door without calling ahead. Phoning a close friend or relative to say you were going to come over could be taken as a sign you did not consider the person close enough to show up unannounced. In North America, barging into someone's house without warning is rude. It doesn't take long when you transplant someone from India to the United States, or from the United States to India, to quickly grasp that the social rules have changed. People adjust to new rules swiftly and automatically, because the hidden brain is highly skilled at orienting itself in new cultural contexts. Healthy people grasp and follow social rules without conscious effort. We do not realize how important these rules are, because we don't do the work of acquiring and following the rules. Our hidden brain does it for us. If you ask a person why she does not reach across a crowded dinner table for a dish, or why she leaves the last potato for someone else, or how she knows one glance in a bar is meaningful but another is not, she will tell you that she has thought about each question and figured out the answer. It isn't true. She may consciously claim responsibility for her answers, but it is really her hidden brain that conducts those analyses. And we know this is true because patients with frontotemporal dementia who do socially inappropriate things have their powers of analysis intact. They can reason their way through life, but it turns out that reason is an inadequate guide in many social situations. It is only when the machinery of the hidden brain breaks down that we suddenly recognize its importance. Much of this book is about errors and biases caused by the hidden brain. The automatic conclusion is that bias is bad, and we should do everything we can to rid the brain of unconscious thinking. If we could only think consciously all the time, we would avoid all the mistakes of the hidden brain. That is partially true, but it is also true that the hidden brain can be our friend. It tells us how to navigate the world. It creates the foundation for our lives as social creatures. It enmeshes us in the web of relationships that make life meaningful. Without the hidden brain, we would not be supercomputing machines that everyone envies. We would be sad creatures, locked out from the very things that make life precious. We would lose the ability to work collegially with others, to form lasting friendships, and to fall in love. Our hidden brain is like the wetness of water that the fish never notices, but can't live without. Morris Friedman, a frontotemporal dementia expert at the Baycrest Center where Wendy McNamara was diagnosed, told me that patients with this disorder often end up in trouble with police and other authorities. It turns out that the most important aspect of being a law-abiding citizen is the ability to understand social rules. We don't avoid shoplifting merely because we consciously know it's wrong, or because it is against the law. Most of us don't shoplift because our hidden brain tells us it is a violation of rules of social interaction. It is the fear of social opprobrium, the contempt of store clerks and security officials and fellow customers if we should get caught, or the shame that would befall us if our friends and colleagues learned about our actions, that keeps people honest, not all the laws in the world. It doesn't feel that way, of course. Most people will tell you they don't shoplift because they are honest folks who can consciously tell right from wrong. It is only when we see patients with a disorder such as frontotemporal dementia that we realize that most of us can claim very little credit for our conscious notions of morality. Patients with frontotemporal dementia don't become bad people, and they don't stop being able to tell right from wrong. They simply stop caring about shame and social opprobrium. These patients will tell you their actions are wrong, but it doesn't bother them. This is why patients with frontotemporal dementia don't just lose their marriages and their friends on account of apathy and indifference. They regularly get into trouble with the law. They also lose their jobs, because it turns out that much of our professional lives is not about the excellence of our work, but about the creation and maintenance of social bonds. One study of 16 patients with frontotemporal dementia found that among them, the group was guilty of unsolicited sexual approach or touching, hit-and-run accidents, physical assaults, shoplifting, public urination, breaking into other people's homes, and even one case of pedophilia. The patients readily acknowledged their actions were wrong, but showed no remorse. They knew they were breaking the law, but it didn't matter to them. Many of our social institutions, and laws in particular, implicitly assume that human actions are largely the product of conscious knowledge and intention. We believe that all we need for a law-abiding society is to let people know what is right and what is wrong, and everything will follow from there. Sure, we make exceptions for people with grave mental disorders, but we assume most human behavior is conscious and intentional. Even when we acknowledge the power of unconscious influence, we believe it can be overcome by willpower or education. When confronted by people who say they understand the law but break it anyway, we lock them up and throw away the key, because in our schema, these have to be bad people. The law does not realize that most law-abiding behavior has little to do with conscious knowledge and motivation. Wendy McNamara, for example, regularly walks into the homes of her neighbors without knocking. Brian McNamara told me that he has explained the situation to everyone who lives nearby, so people don't feel their houses are being broken into. The McNamaras have the good fortune of being surrounded by understanding and compassionate neighbors. And Wendy McNamara is blessed to be married to a man with endless patience and understanding. These patients go to a store and see something they want and pick it up and walk out without thinking of the consequences, Friedman told me. They call their boss fat. Normal people may think their boss is fat, but they're not going to say it. These patients lose the inhibition. These patients get arrested for going up to children and asking for a dollar, he added. If someone sees a person going to a playground and asking kids for a dime and patting kids on the head, they call the cops. Brian McNamara told me that about 9 months after Wendy returned from France with her mother, sister, and her sister's partner, Larry, the family received terrible news. Larry had passed away. It was a non-event for Wendy, Brian McNamara told me. She had known this man for 4 to 5 years. There was no sadness. There wasn't even a silence or a shock when I told her. I told her Larry had passed away and there would be a memorial for him, and she had no reaction. A few years ago, researchers posed a series of dilemmas to patients with damage to a brain area that is implicated in frontotemporal dementia. Some of the dilemmas were trivial, others difficult. The simpler dilemmas included situations such as this. You are driving along a country road when you hear a plea for help coming from some roadside bushes. You pull over and encounter a man whose legs are covered with blood. The man explains that he has had an accident while hiking and asks you to take him to a nearby hospital. Your initial inclination is to help this man, who will probably lose his leg if he does not get to the hospital soon. However, if you give this man a lift, his blood will ruin the leather upholstery of your car. Would you leave this man by the side of the road in order to preserve your leather upholstery? There were dilemmas with higher stakes. You are a 15-year-old girl who has become pregnant. By wearing loose clothing and deliberately putting on weight, you have managed to keep your pregnancy a secret. One day, while at school, your water breaks. You run to the girls' locker room and hide for several hours while you deliver the baby. You are sure that you are not prepared to care for this baby. You think to yourself that it would be such a relief to simply clean up the mess you've made in the locker room, wrap the baby in some towels, throw the baby in the dumpster behind the school, and act as if nothing had ever happened. Would you throw your baby in the dumpster in order to move on with your life? And finally, there were dilemmas where you had to choose between two bad options, both of which involved serious harm to other human beings. Enemy soldiers have taken over your village. They have orders to kill all remaining civilians. You and some of your townspeople have sought refuge in the cellar of a large house. Outside, you hear the voices of soldiers who have come to search the house for valuables. Your baby begins to cry loudly. You cover his mouth to block the sound. If you remove your hand from his mouth, his crying will summon the attention of the soldiers who will kill you, your child, and the others hiding out in the cellar. To save yourself and the others, you must smother your child to death. Would you smother your child in order to save yourself and the other townspeople? The researchers found something curious. Patients with damage to parts of the brain that regulate social behavior did not reach different conclusions from the others. Rather, when it came to the highly charged problems, where people had to choose between two actions that both had terrible consequences, these patients did not experience the distress that normal people felt. They reacted rationally, without emotion. In the scenario involving enemy soldiers combing through a village, the crying child would die anyway if the party hiding in the cellar were discovered. So it is irrational not to smother the child and save the lives of all the other people. Most normal people, however, find the idea of smothering their own child, or any child, unbearable. Patients with damage to a brain area known as the ventromedial prefrontal cortex had no trouble stripping away the emotional component of the problem. From a purely mathematical perspective, it is always better to save many lives instead of one. Research studies into brain disorders that affect social behavior suggest that our basic notions of right and wrong do not spring from what we learn in textbooks and Sunday school, or from laws handed down by messiahs and legislators, but from parts of the brain we hardly understand. Joshua Green, a Harvard neuroscientist and philosopher, told me that much of what we call ethics and morality, in fact, might not be handed down to us by holy books and human laws, but handed up to us by algorithms in the hidden brain, ancient rules developed in the course of evolution. People with normal brain functioning do not need to be taught to care about social relationships, and social relationships lie at the heart of all morality. Does this mean people have no responsibility for immoral actions? Of course not. We have responsibility for not only our conscious minds, but our unconscious minds as well. Not everyone who shoplifts has frontotemporal dementia. But what the extreme examples of these patients provide is the insight that it is the hidden brain, rather than the conscious brain, that creates a society that is law-abiding and just. If we want a moral society, we must actively recruit the help of the hidden brain. We must devise laws that take advantage of our awareness of social rules, and don't just take advantage of our knowledge of the rules that get written down. In the example of the Newcastle Beverage Station, people did not notice that the photograph on the cupboard was changing from week to week. But the reason a pair of watching eyes made a difference at all is that the hidden brain cares about other people's opinions. It is much easier to be honest in situations that encourage and broadcast transparency than in situations where our actions are secret. Frontotemporal dementia is not the only disorder that affects the hidden brain. From schizophrenia and autism to anxiety and depression, patients with a wide range of mental disorders experience damage or dysfunction to parts of the brain that are responsible for unconsciously regulating our behavior. Addictions to heroin, cocaine, or nicotine hijack pathways in the unconscious brain. Once rewired, the hidden brain powerfully manipulates the conscious mind to act against its own will and to justify behavior that is obviously self-destructive. In the case of autism and schizophrenia, a variety of unconscious brain mechanisms go awry. Decreases in gray matter in a part of the brain known as the superior temporal gyrus, for example, appear to be correlated with the delusions and hallucinations that many patients with schizophrenia experience. Changes in brain regions known as the amygdala and the prefrontal cortex appear to be the reason patients with schizophrenia often have trouble reading other people's facial expressions. The ability to read expressions feels like a conscious skill, but turns out to be a largely unconscious process and an essential component of social judgment. A close friend of mine developed schizophrenia some years ago. When we got together for a meal at a restaurant, we happened to get a waiter who was surly. To my friend, the waiter's manner felt threatening. His hidden brain could not distinguish between rudeness and hostility. My friend grew increasingly suspicious, and when I tried to reassure him about the waiter, I became part of the problem. When the waiter placed our food before us, my friend handed me his plate and loudly demanded I give him my plate. He wanted to eat my food and he wanted me to eat his food. The waiter and I exchanged glances. I got the feeling my friend felt the waiter and I were somehow in cahoots, and that we had conspired to have his food poisoned. It was an unlikely scenario, to be sure, but not categorically impossible. How do most of us tell the difference between a surly waiter and a homicidal maniac? We don't conduct investigations. We don't march into restaurant kitchens to see what's being sprinkled on our food. Everyday life depends on our ability to make a series of unconscious assumptions, and one of them is to trust that the food served to us at a clean restaurant is good food. Our hidden brain makes rapid judgments about the likelihood of various scenarios and dismisses the unlikely ones before they can even appear over the horizon of conscious thinking. This is why most of us do not suspect the careless driver who rear-ends our car of trying to kill us, or believe that the medical secretary who asks for our social security number is part of an identity theft crime syndicate. In a world where we have nothing to go on but our rational minds, the simplest things can paralyze us, because it can take huge amounts of time for our conscious brain to think about every scenario deliberately. If we didn't have our hidden brain to weed through thousands of scenarios and to guide our attention to the most pertinent questions, we would quickly become overwhelmed, because bad things can potentially happen to us in every conceivable situation. Everyday life requires us to suspend rationality, to be mindless about countless risks. There is no cure as yet for disorders such as schizophrenia, autism, or frontotemporal dementia. Patients with Wendy's disorder who are in otherwise excellent health can easily outlive their caregivers, which worries Brian McNamara endlessly. He has started to work again and has enrolled Wendy in a day program to practice her social and physical skills. On a recent visit I paid to the McNamaras, Wendy greeted me at the door with a beaming smile and the single word, cute. Brian and Wendy and Evelyn Summers, who was visiting, took me back to a kitchen table overlooking a yard where Wendy used to grow plants. I asked Wendy if she had green thumbs, and she said, maybe so. A moment later, she added, cute. I realized the word was not a judgment, but a tick. Brian showed me a couple of watercolors Wendy had painted many years ago. One showed a cottage snuggled among trees, bathed in dappled sunlight. It was the work of a sure hand and a keen eye. When Brian sets Wendy before paint and brushes now, all she manages are broad strokes one above the other, like a child's rainbow. Inasmuch as Wendy is more sensitive than ever to form and line and color, she no longer has access to the unconscious skills that all artists must possess, the ability to grasp the feeling of a picture and the drive to express that feeling. Wendy abruptly interrupted our conversation about painting to inform me that I had a hole in my right earlobe. I told her this came as news. I later found a deep declivity in my earlobes that I had not noticed before. She asked me to turn my head so she could inspect my other ear. When I obliged, she told me my ears were kinky and small for my head. I had expected Wendy to say and do socially inappropriate things. Her pleasant smile and cheerful demeanor robbed her comments of any sting. I found myself drawn to her authenticity. I told her that narcissistic people might be willing to pay good money to sit before her and have her observe things about them that no one had noticed before. Maybe so, she said. There were some pine cones on the table, and Wendy played with them, passing one hand and then the other over the ridges. She showed me how the ridges were open at the top and bottom of the pine cone, but closed at the middle. Brian asked her how the pine cone felt to her, and she said, again, that the ridges were open at the top and bottom and pressed in at the middle. She had no access to how the pine cone felt. Wendy rose and wandered over to a bowl of potpourri and symmetrically ran her hands over a number of objects. Although she is in the thrall of compulsions, Wendy does not have the feelings typically associated with satisfying or denying compulsions. If there is an open bottle of wine available, Wendy can drain it like water. But if she asks for wine and Brian tells her no bottle is open, she feels nothing. As Brian and Evelyn and I talked, Wendy wandered in and out, sometimes hanging on the periphery of our conversation and other times walking out of the room. At one point, with Wendy back at the kitchen table, we talked about the visit to France. Evelyn reminded Wendy about her late partner, Larry. "You remember Larry? My Larry, don't you?" Evelyn asked. "Maybe so," Wendy replied with a bright smile. "You know he died." "Cute." Wendy loaded dishes into the dishwasher, slowly exploring the ridges and contours of every plate and cup. She washed her hands with soap and water several times and lingered over a towel, her fingers moving over the texture of the cloth like a blind person. She returned to make a comment about my shoes. She asked if she could see the underside of my left sole. I lifted my shoe, and she smiled happily. She then inspected the sole of her sister's shoe. Wendy did not seem offended as Brian and Evelyn talked about frontotemporal dementia. She acknowledged that doctors had given her a diagnosis, but she spoke as one given a doubtful tip about a racehorse. When I asked her if she disagreed with a diagnosis, she smiled pleasantly and said, "Maybe so." One reason frontotemporal dementia is much harder on caregivers than on patients is that victims lack awareness of what they have lost. Wendy never gets angry. It has been years since she shed a tear. She can watch suspenseful shows on television with detachment, observing sound and light and color while remaining untouched by the story. Day-to-day life around her can be light-hearted, even funny. Wendy's comments about my ears made everyone laugh in the same way intensely honest observations from a child can make grown-ups laugh. Being around Wendy was like watching a comedian relate a tragedy, all laughs, cracks, and quips. The sadness lay in what was never said.